Chapter 14.
"My lord,"
a gruff voice from behind me asked,
"what shall we do?"
With my hand still pressed to the rough exterior of the wall, I glanced at Ascara over my shoulder. The older man stared at me evenly and waited for my orders, while Cecilia and Josephine prepared to locate the rest of our soldiers and bring them here. What should we do? The question rang out in my head for a long moment, and I skimmed through our different options. I hadn't suspected Matilda's memory of Tolna would get us this close to the wall, and when I leaned my head up to stare toward the guard towers, I went through each plan thoroughly. We couldn't be caught, not now, especially since we were so close to our attack, but our best bet was to stay here and work on the machine in the dark. "Ascara, how did you construct the ballistae and the catapults?" I asked. "We weren't there when you made them, so I don't know."
"We cut down the trees first," my trusted guard answered quickly. "Then we constructed them during the day. We wanted to do it at night when no one would see or hear us, but we figured if we did it after the sun went down, our lamps would be spotted in the darkness."
"Well, shit," I grumbled, pulled myself away from the wall, and then paced in the shifting sand. "We can't do that either. I'm not sure there are guards up there, maybe a few at every other post, and as soon as they see our lamps, they'd alert the Marchioness."
"Shall we fall back?" Ascara asked.
"Let me think for a moment," I uttered, then resumed my pacing. If we stayed close to the wall, that meant there was a higher chance of us being spotted, and if we moved out farther into the desert, that meant an even higher chance they'd see us coming. If we waited in this position for long, the sun would rise and then sink, casting us entirely in shadow, which could work to our advantage. There was so much about Tolna I didn't know, and that's when it hit me. "Matilda," I called, and immediately the green-haired woman bolted to attention.
"What do you need, stud?"
the desperado asked and hurriedly strode over in her heavy leather boots. "Are there poorer parts of Tolna?" I probed. "Any areas where the guards wouldn't patrol as often compared to this area where we're closest to the entrance?"
"Well, let me tell you one thing, Charlie,"
Matilda drawled out and cupped her chin.
"There is no entrance. They have well, I don't know exactly what to call her, but she can manipulate rock. So when people need out or in, they have three or four areas for her to open for them. There are poorer areas, but they're closer to the edges of the city. I've never been to the capital, but I've heard Tolna is loosely built around the blueprints of the capital."
"Oh, really?"
Edeny purred and sauntered closer.
"Then I might be of some help. My ancestors built most of the capital, and it was my family's idea to construct the three-ring system. It's horrible, yes, because it separates people by class, but with my knowledge, this might be easier than we thought."
"Tell me more," I said.
"Just like with the desert,"
the she-wolf went on, placed her hands behind her back and paced through the sand.
"Think of Tolna like a massive circle."
Edeny bent her knees, dipped down closer to the golden, glittering ground, and drew a large circle in the sand at our feet. I moved closer along with Matilda, and Ascara came to hang over my shoulder.
"This is where the fortification is,"
Edeny continued.
"It's much larger than we suspected."
"Sorry about that,"
Matilda chuckled lightly.
"I've never been good with numbers."
"It's quite all right,"
the wolf woman nodded and then drew two more rough circles in the sand with each one inside of the larger one.
"Like the capital, the smallest ring at the time is where the Marchioness will be. She'll probably have a few high-ranking and powerful officials surrounding her."
The Duchess marked five X's in the sand in the middle of the smallest, third ring. My eyes flicked to her, then back down to the crude drawing as she slashed a line through the middle of the whole thing.
"This represents the canal. Most canals I've encountered come up from underground from the west, so we're going to want to avoid those areas."
"Why?"
the desperado asked.
"We're supposed to find the canal and track down the scientist?"
"Yes, we are."
The stunning aristocrat nodded and then pressed her lips together in a firm line.
"But think about it, both of you. We're in the middle of the desert, and aristocratic canals are usually pristinely clean. They treat the water with special chemicals, so it's good enough to drink. Hell, you could probably bathe in it if you wanted. Here, money is not the most popular currency. Water is. That is why Tolna is different from the capital, where food and water are plentiful."
Edeny hastily turned and drew another large circle in the sand with three more in the middle. Then the she-wolf dragged her finger from the center and created a spiral all the way out to the edge.
"This is what the canal looks like in the capital,"
Edeny stated.
"It moves throughout the whole city, but that's because the capital is built in levels. Of course, the third ring is the highest, the second is a little lower, and then the third is at normal ground level. The water that connects all of the canals spouts from a natural spring underneath the palace, and then flows down from there. Obviously, Tolna hasn't been built that way because I'm assuming it's as flat as the desert. Generally speaking, the northeast areas of a city are poorer than the rest. I don't know why, but every city I've controlled or been to is that way. So, our best bet is to take the caravan, head in that direction, and then camp out. Charles, remember when we were on our way to Boscon?"
"Yes," I uttered, and crooked an eyebrow.
"Our army managed to sneak their way to us with the help of one of the monster women,"
the she-wolf went on.
"She camouflaged everyone and made sure none of the aristocrats on the road saw them. If Cecilia and Josephine can manage to bring them here, I'm sure she can help. But her power must have a limit. We all do."
"We could find a way to work around that," I muttered. "You said the poorest areas in the cities are usually in the northeast. From your past experience, are they usually heavily patrolled?"
"It depends on the person controlling the city."
Edeny sighed heavily and stared down at her drawing in the sand.
"Sometimes there are higher crime rates in those areas because aristocrats assume brutes are thieves. In times like these, where the aristocratic class means almost nothing and property is taken from women with no rhyme or reason, we don't know who could be living in these areas. They very well could be women who have been forced out of their homes without their wealth or titles."
"Matilda," I urged, "you and your women are the only people who have been in the city. Do you know anything about these areas and the people who live there?"
"Of course I do,"
the green-haired desperado nodded.
"We only visited those areas a few times because they weren't really significant to our plans, but we still needed to get the layout of the whole city. Now, the northeastern corner of the city, yes, it was poorer, but I don't remember who was living there."
"It was mainly women,"
a hushed voice whispered into my ear, and I nearly jumped out of my skin at its nearness.
"There were a few men, but we'd heard of something called the relocation. I figured it was either the marchioness of the city or the queen who moved them somewhere else in the city."
"Oh, yeah!"
Matilda nodded with glossy eyes as she remembered.
"Good job, Irene. You got a mind like a steel trap. Nothing gets past her, no siree. There's part of the city we couldn't go into. I remember that now. It was restricted access, and we were escorted in a different direction as soon as we came close to it."
"Do you have any idea what it could be?" I turned, looked directly at the shyest desperado, and asked.
"No."
Irene shook her head.
"There's a wall around the area, a lot like this one, but significantly smaller, and it's crawling with guards. If what the scientist told us is true about more guards being sent in, it'll be even more heavily patrolled than it was. Shadow told me that area was a place of sorrow, and we should keep away from it. Shadow rarely says such things, and that scared me. Whatever is happening in there, Charles Rayburn, we have to stop it."
I'd almost forgotten about the petite, quiet desperado's power until now. When she mentioned it aloud as if it were another person included in the conversation, chills raced up and down my spine. The tiny woman referred to it as Shadow, the ability that sent out toxic tendrils from her body and sucked the life out of anyone who came near her. Matilda explained the second part of Irene acted and responded like a living being, and during late nights the quiet desperado spoke to the creature cohabiting in her. If the being inside of her who was capable of such carnage and destruction said this area was filled with sorrow, I had to wonder what was happening inside that was so terrible. "Then we'll have to plan for that too," I stated. "We'll have to split our strength into two. I don't want the soldiers going in there, only the monster women. Edeny, I may have you be the lead on that mission. You or Josephine and the Drake Legion. I want you to go in there and get it under control as soon as you can. Now, for our next step." I reached into the satchel at my waist, searched around in it for a second, and then gripped the small item I needed. When I pulled it out, I held the small, palm-sized item up to the light and stared down at the glass cover. The compass's needle shook for a second and then righted itself as it pointed east.
I turned and the tiny red arrow moved slightly toward the north. "We need to go that way," I uttered and pointed. "Let's move all of the wagons and caravans as quickly and quietly as possible. We don't want to draw any attention from the guards." Without a moment's hesitation, our party jumped into action. I immediately headed toward the caravan and hauled myself up into the driver's seat. The rest of my soldiers raced about as they prepared to travel the short distance ahead. Most of my women entered back into the caravan's main cabin, but Josephine and Cecilia stood together a little bit away from us. The two Drake women huddled together with their foreheads nearly pressed together. It seemed Josephine was searching out the rest of our party with her telepathy, and once they found them, she'd implant the image of the location in Cecilia's mind. When I'd first met Josephine, the honey blonde hadn't been this strong. If I'd described her as a character in a novel, I would have said she was kind, tender, but also fragile. Sure, she'd admitted her fears to me earlier, but she was stronger than she'd ever been, just like the rest of us. Each time my women and I fought against another enemy, we grew from the experience, and I almost couldn't wait to find out what Tolna was yet to teach us. I paused for a moment and watched as the honey blonde whispered something in Cecilia's ear, and the black drake woman instantly closed her eyes to concentrate. Just as the four times before, a massive portal opened up in the middle of the desert, and slowly but surely my soldiers and monster women appeared out of it. Though most of them looked thoroughly confused, their expressions softened as soon as they spied the rest of us. Once all of them were out and accounted for, I slapped the reins against the horses' backs and crept slowly forward. I kept my eyes glued above me toward the darkened guard towers, but there seemed to be no signs of life in this area. Where were the guards, and what were they doing? Or was it as simple as they couldn't see us from this far away? I held the compass in one hand and the reins in the other as I guided our party toward the specific area where we'd start to dig. Once we reached it, we'd begin to piece my machine together, and then finally, we'd attack. The only sound that came from around us was the whistling of the wind and the occasional clanking of my soldier's armor. I was sure if one of the guards happened to peer over the edge of the wall, they'd see nothing except tiny black dots crawling along the ground like ants. But even then, we were cast in the shadows.
"Oh, I know where we are,"
Matilda breathed, and I glanced over at her as she led her mechanical horse through the sand. "You do?" I muttered.
"Yeah,"
the green-haired woman murmured.
"When we were here last, they were repairing the wall or something like that. There was a big crack in it where the ground underneath had sunken in. They had that rock elemental out there trying to fix it while a bunch of guards were covering it in plaster. But it didn't seem to be helping. Oh, there it is!"
In the dim light, the desperado pointed to the left of me, and I pulled back the reins instinctively to look. Midway up the darkened wall, there was an enormous crack. It looked as if they'd tried to repair it, but the plaster seemed to be flaking away slowly with time, and I was sure the incessant desert wind didn't help. "We should stop here," I ordered, tied off the reins to the driver's seat, and jumped down into the sand. "If the wall is weak, that means the sand and stone underneath are, too." Without a moment's hesitation, I hurried down the caravan toward the rear cabin. Once I reached it, I found the latches that held the door closed and quickly undid them before lowering the hatch down. The light inside my laboratory was dim since most of the candles I lit had burned down, and I gestured toward the massive engine inside. "We're going to have to work in the dark," I told my whole army in front of me. "And it's going to be difficult, but I want all of the women who can see in the dark and any men who've worked in machinery before to come forward. We're going to rely heavily on all of you. Now, where's Florence, the woman with the camouflage ability?"
"I'm here, Charles,"
a woman called from the crowd, and then stepped forward with a shy smile. "Good," I nodded. "This is going to sound extremely taxing, but I need you to cover the entire army. Can you do that? We need to make sure no one sees us, especially after the sun comes up. Do you think you can do that, or will it be too difficult?"
"Yes,"
Florence assured me.
"There were a few women after me who have a variant of the same power, and we can work as a team."
"Very good," I smiled. "Now, it's time for us to finish this. I want it done by morning. We will work tirelessly until the sun comes up, and even then we won't be finished. After our digger is ready, it will be time for battle. Now, I will get everything out of the way and tell you our plan. The digger can only hold a certain amount of people, and the motor is only drivable by one person. So in total, only 2 to 3 people can fit inside.
The space inside of the machine is used to dig out the earth, rock, and sand. It spreads it out evenly on either side of the digger instead of throwing it back behind it. So, once the digger is in and has cleared a path, all of us will follow along behind it. Once it surfaces on the other side of the fortification, we'll pour out and take Tolna. I will be inside the machine driving it, and Askara will be inside with me. The rest of you will follow after into the hole, but I have a special job for Ryan.
Me?
The imp woman gasped. I've done a lot of reading the last few days, I chuckled, and addressed the whole crowd. There are a lot of things I didn't know about imps that I should have before, such as, imps can sense solid objects underneath the rock as they're digging. They even can sense changes in pressure, the presence of water, and other mammals.
Yes,
the red-skinned beauty nodded. But then she looked thoroughly confused.
But I don't understand, Charles. What will my special mission be?
You will go in front of the machine, I instructed. You will be our leader and show us where we need to go to get in and out safely. You can sense all of those things underneath the rock, so it only makes sense that you'd be the one to lead us down there. Do you think you can do it?
Do I think I can do it?
The black-haired beauty repeated, threw back her head, and cackled toward the darkened sky.
Hell yes, I can. Charles, I've been waiting for this. Oh man, I haven't tunneled in months. This is going to be so fun. This is great. I finally get to show off my natural talents.
Good, I growled, and then clapped my hands together. Now, let's get to work. As soon as the sun rises, I want all of this finished. Do you hear me? We have the opportunity of a lifetime ahead of us, men, and we're going to seize it before it runs away like a scared rabbit. Instantly, a few of my men lifted their arms and weapons into the air. Their voices stayed silent, but from their expressions in the dim light, they were more than ready to tear Tolna down and build my new empire in its place. Soldiers rushed forward at once and then shouldered into the tiny space of my laboratory before they slowly but surely carried the enormous engine out of the cabin. Once it was out, I hurried into the room and ripped up the blueprint from the tabletop of my desk. Askara rushed over and stood near me in the dim light as I showed him the machine we needed to construct over the next few hours. Sunrise is at 7 a.m., I commented, and Askara's spine snapped to attention.
"Excuse me, my lord," the guard whispered. "We won't finish by then. That's only 2 or 3 hours away."
You underestimate our manpower and willpower, I chuckled lightly, and then stepped down the small incline to the sand. Look at them, Askara. Just take a moment and look. As soon as one of my soldiers saw me with the blueprint in my hands, he rushed over and I handed it to him. The young man took a few minutes to scan the drawing and the pieces we would need to craft the monstrous digger. Then he began whispering out orders to his comrades. "They're not doing this because I told them to do it," I uttered in an awestruck tone. "They're not doing it because I'm their leader, and they have to obey me, Askara. They're doing it because they believe in our cause. They understand Tolna is not just a city. It's a stepping stone on our way to the capital. It's another notch in our belt. When I look at cities like Burskan, Granum, and Tolna, I don't see them as towns where people live. I see them as awards, trophies, if you will. There are so many of us now, Askara, and it's because we came together to fight our oppression. We've been the loyal hounds for too long. We've sat at our mistress's feet for too long. And now it's time for us to bite the hand that feeds us, if you can even call their treatment of our sex feeding us. I'm sure they consider it that, but the time is now, Askara. Look at everything we've done so far."
"I didn't mean to doubt you, my lord," the guard interjected and bowed his head respectfully. "I'm just worried we won't finish by the time you want."
"Even if we don't," I stated, "we have ways to protect ourselves while we finish. Now, we can't just stand here while they work. I am their leader, but I won't sit back and let them break their backs for my approval. I've got to earn my keep, don't I? No one likes a lazy king." I laughed heartily, slapped my guard on the shoulder, and then hurried down toward the soldiers and monster women working. Askara quickly followed after me, and the two of us aided our brothers and sisters in the workload. The first thing we had to construct was the digger's outer shell around the motor I'd already built. With the amount of help we had, it would be reasonably straightforward. But the most challenging part was adhering all of the pieces together. We'd have to use the portable welder I'd crafted a long time ago, but the light from it could catch the guard's attention.
Thankfully, Florence and her sisters were able to camouflage most of us, and then Valerie moved the caravan so it blocked us from view from above. The feline woman helped us more than by just moving the caravan. The ash blonde managed to create small shields of invisibility around the welder as we used it to put the pieces together. The way I designed the digger, the outer shell was entirely comprised of fitting portions of metal that constantly shifted and moved to hollow the hole we'd created. Instead of using legs or wheels to push it forward, the motor would force this outer interlocking shell to slither along almost like a snake while the front, a pointed spiral, would carve its way underground. This machine would be magnificent and terrifying, an absolute wonder of my ingenious brain. But I couldn't marvel at it for long since we had to keep working. Once the outer shell was finished, it spanned almost 25 feet in length, and when I stood next to it, it was 3 or so feet taller than I was. The metal struts were attached together by scissor hinges that moved smoothly in and out as the digger's front moved forward, giving it the snake-like appearance. Once the outer shell was in place, we began to work on the plates that worked together to move the digger forward through the sand and then pushed it downward when it was time to dig. They were relatively easy to craft, but the most difficult task was laying them together and then placing their wires in the engine's outputs. Slowly but surely, my digger started to emerge from the mass of dark gray metal. I didn't even want to call it a digger anymore, because it had lost all concept of that name by now. It was more of a tunneler or a mole machine. Once the plates underneath were finished, we moved on to covering the outside with the movable, shifting panels I'd attached electrically to the motor. The biggest concern I had about this was I hadn't crafted a large enough engine to power all of these moving parts, but there was only one way to find out. We worked together tirelessly fitting and placing each interlocking panel onto the sides until it looked as if it were covered in heavy armor. The front end and back end both tapered to points, almost as if it were a gigantic living serpent, but I prayed I never encountered one this large. The reason why I'd chosen this point to start our attack was the cracked wall. As I'd explained earlier, it meant sandstone was already weak. But if we attacked it with our cannons, ballistae, and catapults, they still wouldn't get through. On the other hand, the digger could, because the sand and dirt underneath the fortifications were already broken or sinking below the average level of the ground. Things like that often happened with cities who built walls around themselves. An earthquake could hit and destroy the rock or earth underneath it and cause it to tilt or shift. Or a sinkhole could have opened up underneath, or even the natural erosion that happened over hundreds of years. This would work out perfectly for us. And I thanked science that no one had been out here to fix it yet. Their negligence would be their own downfall. We worked long and hard with the aid of my monster women, those who shielded us with their powers, and those who worked on the machine along with us. My back ached every time I moved. My skin was slick with sweat, and my hands felt as if they were covered in thousands of tiny cuts. But I'd never felt so alive. We've never done anything like this, and it was invigorating. All of the times I'd built our machines, I'd done it alone, either in the lonesome comfort of the manor or the laboratory at the back of the caravan. But here in the middle of the desert, I had help for the very first time. It was a strange feeling because, at this moment, I wasn't their leader or their future king. I was their comrade and friend. But that's what I wanted for our future together. I didn't want my people to look at me on my throne and say, "That is an untouchable man. That is an unapproachable leader who will not listen to our problems." I wanted to be the king of the people who was beloved for his actions and kindness. We'd already lived through times with hateful, iron-willed leaders, and we didn't need another one. The people of this country needed someone they could believe in and trust with their issues and problems. When I accepted I was the only one who could make changes to society, I had already accepted my position. When my soldiers left their positions and melted back into society, I wanted them to look back at this time and think, "My king stood by my side. My king fought shoulder to shoulder with his men. He didn't send out pawns to sacrifice themselves for him. He was ready and willing to die for us just as we were for him." When I glanced at the men around me, I didn't see emotionless brutes who'd lost hope and joined a side they disagreed with just to get out of their past situations. These were men who decided to fight by my side because they believed they deserved to live lives filled with happiness and freedom.
I would give that to them, all of them, and I would kill and maim until every man in the country was free. This wasn't just about freeing the men, either. I also wanted to release the aristocrats of their oppression. They'd been born into positions and then groomed their entire lives to believe they were the highest on the food chain. My machine would fix some of them, and those who didn't need it, the harlots, would find husbands and live fulfilling lives just as I wanted for them. These were all of the things I fought for. Each time we finished a part of my monstrous machine, I reminded myself of why we were doing this. It wasn't just about me and my needs anymore. It was us as a whole from the moment I collected my first group of soldiers, and it would continue to be that way even after I'd taken the throne. I'd barely realized the sun had come up until the reflection glowed against the cold steel of my serpentine machine. I squinted my eyes against it, raised my right hand, and stood to my full height. We'd worked for so long I'd lost track of time, and suddenly I shuffled backward in the warming sand and stared at the beautiful digger before me.
"It's..."
Edeny breathed over my shoulder.
"Charles,"
Valerie whispered.
"Is it finished?"
I stared at it, glanced over every interlocking panel, and then pressed my sore hands to my hips. The digger was 20 feet long and entirely comprised of steel and iron, except for in the inner workings, which were partly leftover copper, electrical components, and thick black wiring. At the top, there was a hatch where Askara and I would drop down into it and then slip into the controls. A small window was placed right above the spinning driver that would break apart the rock and dirt. The glass was double-glazed, so even if a rock came hurtling back at it, it wouldn't shatter or crack. "Yes," I murmured, and then a wide grin spread over my features. "Yes, it's finally finished."
"My lord?"
Askara probed, hurried over, and slammed his closed fist over his chest.
"What is our next course of action?"
"It's time for us to dig and take over this city,"